of war, the notion that you can go to war against terrorism, none of these candidates were prepared to say, you can't bomb terrorism, you can only bomb people, and that creates more terrorism, not less.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, but of course, we'll continue to cover these issues. Phyllis Menes, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Bill Curry, weekly columnist with Salon.com, will link to your articles. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gaddis, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield, Mimran Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Are you still looking for a way to fit KBOO into your year-end giving? KBOO Community Radio is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. For the past 11 years, the Give Guide has raised nearly $13 million for hundreds of local nonprofits. Help us reach our $20,000 goal and look KBOO up on the giveguide.org website. And make a donation today before December 31st. Remember, we have a one-to-one match for all new and increasing donations too. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
Taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you. It's the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, KBOO's all-vinyl guilty pleasure. Monday nights, midnight to 1 a.m. on 90.7 FM stereo and around the world at KBOO.FM.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
The Overlook Neighborhood Association in North Portland has again called on the city to evict a houseless camp on Greeley Avenue.
A new trial date has been set for a Baltimore police officer involved in the death of Freddie Gray.
A victory for wolves in Washington as a judge rules that a state agency cannot continue to kill wolves on public land.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 21st, 2015. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. The Overlook Neighborhood Association met last week to discuss the City of Portland's plan to issue a possible permit for two nearby homeless camps. About 75 people attended. While expressing compassion for the camps and the broader issue of homelessness in Portland, neighborhood residents voiced safety and health concerns for both the campers and the neighborhood. Based on the meeting and a previous meeting with a City of Portland representative, the association provided a list of conditions to be included in any permit approved for the camps. For more information, KBOO's Ken Jones spoke with Chris Trejaban, a board member of the Overlook Neighborhood Association.
Chris, at a meeting last week of the Overlook Neighborhood Association, neighbors voiced concerns about the homeless camp near the intersection of North Interstate and North Greeley Avenue. What were those concerns?
Well, primarily our concerns are for the health and safety of the people that the city's asking to camp down there. I don't know if you've seen this site, but it's at the base of the bluff along the river and kind of underneath the Overlook Park. And it's a site that in the recent rains has effectively been underwater. It's also subject to landslides. They haven't been in it yet. We're a little worried about the stability of the slope. It's concerning that this is the best that Portland seems to be capable of doing, and really Portland needs to do a lot better.
As a result of the meeting, and many of the neighbors who were there came out against the city's plan to issue a permit to all homeless camps on the site, how did you communicate this opposition to the city after the meeting?
Well, the board at the meeting voted to send a letter to the city asking for certain requirements to be included in the permit. And this goes back to a meeting that was held about 2 weeks ago with the city, in which they announced this plan and asked us what we would like to see included in a permit. So having had a chance now to discuss it with our residents in the neighborhood, we've made that list available to the city.
Oh, and I actually have the list here, but just for our listeners, would you be able to maybe summarize it or mention a few of the conditions that you've included in this request to the city?
Sure. The city has, since the camp opened and the city started talking about issuing the permit, said that this was a temporary, short-term solution. So one thing we'd like to see is a fixed end date for when exactly short-term is short-term or temporary is temporary. We envision that being about a year out to coincide with the period that the city's emergency ordinance for homelessness will expire. That's in October 2016. The city and the campers have talked about limiting the number of people there, and we agree it's not a site that can host a lot of people, and originally the discussion was about 25 people would camp there. It's currently around 75. We think a safe number is about 30, and that's a number that's been bantered around by the city as well and by the campers, although subsequently there was talk of adding a second camp, which would bring that number up. We think 30 is probably the right spot to be. Other requirements we'd like to see in there is to have campers provide the city with their legal name. This is just simply a matter of if the city is going to be a landlord, it ought to know who's leasing a spot, for lack of a better word. The Hazelnut Grove camp down there has a code of conduct. We think that needs to be written into the permit, that everyone will follow that code as well as city laws in the camp and also if they're out and about in the neighborhood or in Overlook Park. There's a few other things, mostly about safety and, you know, preventing potential conflicts with people passing through.
Is there anything in there about how the city would enforce these conditions?
The intent, from what we understand for the city, is to have the camp be self-governing. And we think as long as there's a suitable set of rules in place, there's a role for self-governance down there. But given that this is a public land and this is a publicly issued permit, we think there should be some monitoring on the part of the city. And ideally, that would mean having Portland police go through periodically to make sure campers are following the rules that they've agreed to by accepting the permit.
Given the Neighborhood Association's opposition to a homeless camp permit, do you think that will influence the city's decision, or are you getting kind of the communications from the city or feeling that the permit will be approved nonetheless?
Our impression is that the city plans to go ahead with the permit. Whether they take some of our, what I view as very reasonable requests for health and safety seriously remains to be seen. I know when we've discussed a couple of these with the city and with the campers, there was some opposition to what we proposed. For example, neither really wanted to see a firm deadline on when they would close the camp down, which says to us when they say temporary, they don't really mean it. We're hoping, though, that they were serious when they asked us for input and that they'll consider it seriously.
Chris, one final question, and I know this is not an easy one. You know, it's a very complex and difficult challenge. How to house the homeless or where to set up these camps. But did the association mention any alternatives to putting a homeless camp in the Overlook neighborhood?
We have not spent a lot of time trying to identify a specific site. We're aware of one property owner who has approached the city regarding using a building he owns to house the homeless. I've heard there's some problems with that building, so it might not be feasible. Honestly, though, our view is this is a Portland problem. It's not just an Overlook problem. And so we as a city need to be talking about what is a place that we can offer genuine shelter to our homeless population. Telling them to just set up camps along the river in a wet, cold spot is not adequate. Maybe there's just another spot in Overlook. We would be happy to talk to the city about that and to try and find that spot as part of a comprehensive discussion. The city has not been willing to engage in that conversation with us to date.
We've been talking with Chris Trable, a board member of the Overlook Neighborhood Association. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
KBOO's Jimmy Tardy recently spoke with Ryan Pritcher, a resident of the Hazelnut Grove houseless encampment, about the way the camp is organized.
We're pretty much self-governing for the most part. There's a lot of autonomy. But there, as far as leadership, Joe and Jose take kind of leadership positions, and they're also the ones probably who I would consider to be like camp leaders. But as far as like self-governments, it's really the individual has to be willing to abide by a code. We have a code of no drugs, no hard drugs, you know, and which means no needles and no violence.
You said no hard drugs, no needles, and no violence?
Yeah.
And how's that been working out?
Pretty good. We're trying to keep some of the more unsavory and unstable element out of the camp, and which is hard to do because a lot of that is camped out right next door to us at Forgotten Realms. But with the permit, I think basically we're Hazelnut Grove is in and Forgotten Realms is out.
Is there anything else you want to say about what Hazelnut Grove means to you and the other people that are there?
Sure. It means opportunity. It means opportunity to make an example of how to handle this emergency, this state of emergency. Homelessness is an emergency, is a human emergency. And this is an opportunity to show how to handle homelessness. Just like, for example, in the Depression, you know, you had all kinds of people, all kinds of homeless popping up all over the place. And how do you live without a home? You know, how can you, is there a place to go? Is there food? Is there safety? Is there warmth? Is there a way to keep out of the rain? All the questions that most people who have jobs and who have homes, they get to a point where they take it for granted, you know, where they are so used to their lives that they just take, you know, for granted for the life that they have, and they don't stop and appreciate, you know, to be thankful for their house and for the resources that they're able to consume and the amount of security and safety they have in those things.
I've been speaking with Brian Fritcher. He is a resident of Hazelnut Grove, which is the homeless encampment in the Overlook neighborhood that has been recently assured by Portland City Mayor Charlie Hale's office that they will not be swept by the Portland Police Bureau and that the process is moving forward to receive a conditional use permit for them to continue in the site with some conditions. Thanks, Ryan.
No problem.
The three water reservoirs on Mount Tabor have been officially disconnected from the city water system and no longer provide any water to the city. The reservoirs were ordered closed after new U.S. EPA regulations required all open drinking water reservoirs throughout the country to either be covered or disconnected, but the reservoirs will remain on Mount Tabor. The Portland Water Bureau, in conjunction with the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association, agreed to preserve and restore the historical appearance of the three reservoirs. The Portland Water Bureau is asking the City Council for $750,000 in next year's budget to hire a preservation consultant in order to achieve these goals. The City Council has already agreed to spend up to $4 million on the restoration project.
The highest amount of rain for any December in the past 75 years in the Portland area is being followed by wind gusts today strong enough to disrupt electric power and bring down trees. Area gusts were predicted to be as high as 65 miles per hour. Rainfall continues to drench the area. Showers in the city and suburbs should continue into Wednesday and Thursday, turning to snow as they reach the Cascades, where several feet of snow has already been dumped over the past few weeks. Snow levels are expected to drop to around 500 feet by Christmas Eve. However, the few snowflakes likely to fall on the Willamette Valley by Christmas Day will not exactly make for a classic white Christmas.
A possible terrorist attack in Northern California was thwarted earlier today when authorities raided the home of William Celi. Celi, a 55-year-old Donald Trump supporter, was arrested after authorities received a tip that he had been building explosives and was planning to attack a local mosque. In recent years, there has been an average of 12 violent hate crimes per month directed towards Muslims in America. Since the terror attacks in Paris last month, the number has more than tripled, rising to 38 per month. These attacks include arson and vandalism of mosques, shootings, and death threats. KABU reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Zahra Belou of the Council on American-Islamic Relations to learn more.
Zahra Belou, I'm the executive director of the San Francisco Bay Area Office of CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. So I got word via media reports yesterday about a terror plot against the Muslim community in Richmond, California that was thwarted yesterday. And my initial reaction was horror. That is so frightening. As we talk so much about terrorism as a problem where Muslims are exclusively the suspects, but this scenario, like others, demonstrates that Muslims are also victims of terrorism and that it's a problem that is not unique to any single community.
Well, and this one, at least, was thwarted before he could actually commit any acts of violence, as far as we know, at least. Just a couple of weeks ago, though, Carl Dial Jr., I believe, was arrested for an act of arson against a mosque, correct?
Correct, yes. There has been an unprecedented increase in the number of attacks against Muslim individuals and organizations. In just the few weeks following the Paris and San Bernardino terror attacks, we've seen mosques get firebombed. We've seen store clerks get shot in the face. We've seen vandalisms and attacks on individuals. And so this seems to be part of a larger, very dangerous trend.
And in fact, there's a research group out of California State University at San Bernardino that has been doing the research. They found it's a tripling of attacks. Is that correct?
I'm not familiar with that report in particular, but I do know that what we've seen through various reports is that there has been like an unprecedented number, more in the last 6 to 8 weeks than at any other comparable period of time in the last 15 years.
Now, there's a news conference earlier today in D.C. Your organization and some others were announcing a new initiative. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. So, because of the unprecedented rise in dangerous anti-Muslim rhetoric, a number of organizations, including CARE, the Islamic Society of North America, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, and others, came together through an umbrella group called the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations, and they've unveiled a number of initiatives, including launching a major voter registration drive as a means of pushing back and holding accountable politicians that use fear and divisiveness to win votes or campaign money.
So could you speak for a moment to the sort of escalation in the rhetoric that we've been seeing in the last several months here in the U.S. and the rising crime, the hate crimes and such?
Sure. So what we're concerned about is that politicians like Donald Trump, Ben Carson, and others have normalized anti-Muslim hate, made it socially acceptable for people like this terrorist in Richmond to attack members of the Muslim community.
How can people find out about CARE, and how do people get involved in trying to stem this tide of hate and violence?
People who want to learn more about CARE can visit our national website where they can connect with all of our chapters. It's just CAIR.com. And if they want to get involved in pushing back against Islamophobia, we recommend that they reach out to their local CARE chapter or even a local mosque in the area and get to know their fellow Muslims, their fellow Americans.
Zahra, thank you so much for your time.
Not at all. Thank you for doing this.
This is Doug McVeigh with KABU News.
Several dozen Portlanders gathered in Pioneer Square yesterday to call for an end to Islamophobia in the city and around the country. It was the second such gathering in as many weeks. The march and vigil was organized by Muslim and interfaith groups as well as Jewish Voice for Peace. Yesterday's march called for United Voices on Violence to condemn the Daesh attacks in Paris and the San Bernardino shooting, while opposing Trump's rhetoric on banning Muslims from entering the United States. They also challenged the increasing Islamophobia that has been documented around the country. Several local groups will be leafleting and holding vigils in the coming weeks to oppose Islamophobia and to challenge the assertion that Islam is connected to terrorism.
The Somalian-based group Al-Shabaab has, over the last several years, targeted non-Muslim civilians in attacks like one last April, in which they murdered 148 students at a Kenyan college, singling out and executing Christians. So it was no surprise when they attacked a bus last week near the northeastern village of El Waq on the Somali border and attempted to separate Christian passengers from Muslims on board. But this time, a group of Kenyan Muslims protected the Christian passengers. They refused to let themselves be split into groups, telling the militants to, quote, kill them together or leave them alone. While at least two people were killed in the attack, the militants decided to leave after the passengers' show of unity. Last year, Al-Shabaab attacked a bus near Mandera and murdered 28 non-Muslims traveling to Nairobi for the Christmas holidays. That attack caused the departure of more than 2,000 teachers and as many health workers who had come from other parts of the country to serve in North Kenya. Somali fighters have increased the number and severity of their raids into Kenya after the Kenyan government sent troops into Somalia in 2011. The United States has declined to intervene in Somalia since 1993 after having bombed civilian areas and armed both sides of the conflict.
Human rights advocates have called for an investigation following the Nigerian army's raid on a Shia Muslim area last week, in which hundreds of people were reportedly killed. Details of the attack have been slow to emerge, as the three areas that were invaded by the military remain on lockdown. No residents have been allowed to enter or leave. Amnesty International said in a statement that the shooting of hundreds of civilians by the Nigerian military must be urgently investigated and that those responsible must be brought to justice. Ibrahim Musa, a spokesman for the Shia Islamic movement in Nigeria, said soldiers on Monday carried away about 200 bodies from around the house of a religious leader who himself was badly wounded. Hundreds more corpses were brought into the morgue, according to Musa. The army said troops attacked sites in the Zaria after 500 Shias blocked the convoy of the army chief. The army admitted that people were killed for allegedly blocking the road, but did not say how many were killed. Hundreds of Shia Muslims protested in front of Nigerian embassies in several different countries.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. Then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Host Adam Carpinelli interviews Chauncey Peltier, son of political prisoner Leonard Peltier. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, showers likely, mainly before 10 p.m., then a chance of rain after 4 a.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 39. Tomorrow, rain, mainly after 10 a.m., high near 45, south wind 6 to 8 miles per hour. Today in history, in 1970, Elvis Presley met with President Richard Nixon in the Oval Office to discuss the fight against drugs. And in 1995, control of the city of Bethlehem was passed from Israel to the Palestinian National Authority. The quote of the day is from the late Sam Ervin, the North Carolina Democrat who chaired the Senate Watergate Committee, who said, "The most precious value of civilization is the right of a citizen under the Constitution not to be unduly oppressed by his government. There are people that wouldn't steal a penny of your money, but who would steal your vote. That's an odd kind of morals."
It's 5:23. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Here's a twist on Christmas that would make Jesus weep. First, a right-wing faction in the U.S. has been wringing its hands over a hokey cultural crisis cooked up by the faction itself, namely that liberals, atheists, humanists, and, God forbid, Marxists are waging a war on Christmas. The infidels are not accused of lobbing bombs in this war, but words of mass destruction. Specifically, the right-wing purists wail that unholy lefties are perverting the season by saying Happy Holidays instead of Merry Christmas. Second, some ultra-conservative members of this same faction have launched their own war against Jesus. How twisted is this? They say no one should mess with the word Christmas, yet they're messing with the guy Christmas is supposed to be about. Okay, technically, they're not going directly at Jesus, but at a key part of his message, and in particular, at a key messenger of Christianity, Pope Francis. They've decided that the Pope is a Marxist, pointing out that Francis speaks often about the, quote, structural causes of poverty, the idolatry of money, and the new tyranny of unfettered capitalism. Obviously, say the pontiff's pious critics, that's commie talk. The clincher for them was when Francis wrote an official papal document in which he asked in outrage, how can it be that it is not a news item when an elderly homeless person dies of exposure, but it is news when the stock market loses 2 points? See, cried the carpers, that's proof that Francis is the Red Pope. But wait, that was a very good question he asked, one ripe with the moral wrath that Jesus himself frequently showed toward the callous rich and their love of money. Indeed, the Pope's words ring with deep ethics you find in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Was he a commie too? This is Jim Hightower saying, could it be that the carpers are actually the ones lacking in real Christmas spirit?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Conservationists in Washington state are celebrating after a federal court decided to halt proposed wolf killings in the state. Judges told Wildlife Services, a federal program, that it couldn't continue with its plan to eradicate wolf packs in Washington state because the impacts are too uncertain and risky. The court rejection of wolf killing was in response to a challenge by a coalition of conservation organizations. KBOO's Joanna Peterson spoke with Nick Cady, who's part of the coalition that challenged Wildlife Services.
So what exactly was Wildlife Services planning to do before federal court rejected their plans?
Wildlife Services last year kind of issued a national environmental policy document, a document basically planning to shoot wolves in Washington. They're going to be essentially the trigger men for the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Could you just give me a little more background on Wildlife Services?
Wildlife Services is part of the Department of Agriculture, and essentially their role is to exterminate animals all over the country throughout states. They usually have cooperative agreements with various counties or states to kill wildlife, and this ranges from, you know, beavers to bears to otters to cougars and also wolves. And so we've been kind of after this agency for a long time because they're relatively unregulated. They have no administrative rules. They have no oversight. A big congressional investigation was launched into them. It was headed by Representative Peter DeFazio. But they've been largely unaccountable and killing tons of wildlife and doing it without any meaningful environmental analysis of what the impacts of what they were doing is having on the environment.
So then in the recent court decision, they were just told that they would not be able to continue to do this without regulation, or what was exactly the outcome?
Well, the outcome was a statewide injunction against them killing wolves until they conducted, more meaningful analysis, but it involved a number of things. They have to look at kind of the environmental impacts and the ecological impacts of what they're, when they kill wolves, what's this doing to Washington's environment. They also need to take a hard look at the effects that this will have on Washington's wolf population as a whole. So if they're going to kill a number of wolves, what will this do to different population levels? And they need to do this in the context of a full environmental impact statement instead of just a brief assessment. And that involves a number of different things. They have to look at the economic impacts. They have to look at just much more detail than they have been operating under previously.
What types of impacts are you worried about from these wolf killings?
Well, in Washington, what we've seen is about every year the state has exterminated an entire pack of wolves, and the population has stagnated. This is kind of what's happened in the Southwest with the Mexican gray wolves. Down there was regular extermination of wolves, and the impacts were severe, and the population just stagnated by taking out a lot of these members of their kind of communities, because wolves are pack animals, they rely on kind of the connections with their community to propagate and survive.
How should livestock owners deal with wolves in other ways besides having them exterminated?
So livestock owners currently in Oregon and Washington have the authority to defend their livestock. They can kill wolves to protect their livestock. What we have enjoined through this court case is state paid for, so taxpayer money, active extermination of entire packs of wolves. So that's what's being prevented, not an ability for a livestock owner to protect his livestock. They can do that. They have that authority. This does not affect that.
And what's next in your interactions with Wildlife Services after this recent case?
This recent action against Wildlife Services is largely the result of a recent court decision down in New Mexico. We've been going after Wildlife Services for over a decade because they just really didn't do any analysis or any meaningful reason behind their wildlife killing program. We think that if you took a hard look at these programs, you know, you don't need to come back every year and kill all the beavers in a certain watershed or trap all the bears off timberland. We think this is kind of an unnecessary wildlife management that kind of, you know, is a self-replicating process. So, you know, if Wildlife Services goes in and kills all the animals one year, they're going to have to keep on doing it year and year and year if they want the same level of damage control. We think there are more responsible ways to manage wildlife than just killing them year and poisoning them year after year after year. And so what we're hoping is that kind of these recent decisions that have allowed us, that have kind of held Wildlife Services accountable, finally will start leading to kind of a programmatic change within the agency, the development of some meaningful administrative rules, and just a harder look at what they're actually doing.
I've been speaking with Nick Cady with Cascadia Wetlands. We've been discussing how a federal court rejected plans to escalate wolf killing in Washington state by the secretive federal program dubbed Wildlife Services. For KBOO News, I'm Joanna Peterson.
Looking for an exciting vacation destination for the entire family? Try Hanford, Washington, one of America's newest national parks. Worried about exposure to nuclear waste? No problem, say officials. The toxic waste dumps will be miles away from the B reactor, the main attraction. In November, the Manhattan Project National Historic Park was signed into existence. In addition to Hanford, the new national parks will include sites at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and Los Alamos, New Mexico. Tours will be conducted from April through October. The focus will be on the history of the location and how this location changed the world by unleashing the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which U.S. government officials claim is what caused Japan to surrender. In 1943, Hanford went from being a sleepy little ranching community of 300 residents to the largest and most deadly nuclear weapon construction site in the country. 9 reactors were built, creating over 56 million gallons of radioactive waste. Our government spends over $1 billion a year trying to maintain and clean up this toxic mess. Now, they hope to lure tourists to the site by calling it a National Historic Park.
A pipe for a large natural gas well in Southern California's San Fernando Valley has broken, leading to an uncontrolled release of natural gas into the atmosphere. The natural gas spill is being called the largest in the country since the BP Gulf Oil well blowout in 2010. Local schools have closed and 1,700 families have been temporarily relocated. Another 1,000 families are demanding that they also be relocated away from the noxious natural gas fumes that contain multiple chemicals including benzene and methane. The leak is so large that in 4 months it will more than double the entire state's annual level of methane releases. The owner of the natural gas well, the Southern California Gas Company, is drilling a relief well in hopes it can cap the broken pipe located more than 8,000 feet underground. The leak was discovered on October 23rd, and authorities admit it will be late March before a cap can be installed to stop the leak.
Dozens are believed to be dead, and more than 90 people are missing after a massive landslide in China buried more than 30 buildings. The landslide occurred at a large industrial dump near the city of Shenzhen. Area residents had complained about the largely illegal dump for years, warning of a high landslide potential during the heavy rains of the monsoon season. More than 1,500 search and rescue workers are searching the area for survivors. The slide covered an area of more than 15 acres and buried buildings several stories deep in a reddish-brown muck filled with industrial waste.
As monkeys and birds in tropical forests disappear due to hunting and loss of habitat, hardwood trees are disappearing too. The valuable hardwood trees are being replaced with soft-wooded trees. Seems the monkeys and birds plant the hardwood trees by eating the fruit, then defecating the seeds, thereby replanting the more valuable hardwoods. One of the problems with these disappearing animals and hardwoods is the fact that the hardwood trees also store a lot of carbon, much more than softwood trees taking their place. While some groups focus on deforestation as the cause of adding to the carbon emissions, other scientists point out the symbiotic relationship with the large woolly spider monkeys, tapirs, and toucans, and the planting of the hardwood trees. When the large animals are gone, the forest is gone. Some of the notable trees that are in decline are important human food sources, such as Brazil nut, wild cacao, and the acai trees.
Four innocent Native American men have been set free from prison after they agreed not to sue the government for their wrongful convictions. Eugene Vint, Kevin Pease, George Friz, and Marvin Roberts, known as the Fairbanks Four, have all been sitting in jail since 1997 for the murder of teenager John Hartman. Even at the time of the conviction, the case was extremely controversial, with many supporters of the four insisting on their innocence. Family and supporters have continued to fight over the years, collecting evidence of their innocence and pushing for a new trial. As the years went on, the case against them fell apart, and it became obvious that the state had locked away innocent men. A new trial was finally granted this month, and the four wrongfully convicted men were quickly released after the new evidence was finally brought to light. Fearing legal retribution, the court forced the innocent men to agree that they would not sue the state or city. Prisoner rights advocates say that this case points to a growing trend in law enforcement, forcing prisoners to sign agreements that they will not sue for being wrongfully convicted. Supporters of the Fairbanks Four also point out that Native Americans regularly face police brutality and discrimination in the justice system. According to the Free Thought Project, the racial group most likely to be killed by law enforcement is Native Americans, followed by African Americans.
A Texas grand jury convened today to decide whether criminal charges should be brought in the case of Sandra Bland, a 28-year-old black woman found dead in police custody last summer. Bland was stopped on July 10th for failing to use her turn signal. Her encounter with the police officer escalated, and she was taken into custody. Bland died in jail 3 days later, and police claimed she had used a plastic bag to hang herself in her cell. Her death was ruled a suicide. A video from the officer's dash cam was released and helped fuel protests by groups such as Black Lives Matter and Say Her Name. The officer who stopped Bland was placed on administrative duty for violating agency regulations during the stop. Also, Texas state officials found that Bland's jailers made mistakes when processing her. This morning, the Waller County District Attorney's Office would only say the grand jury was convened. Officials would not say if jurors were discussing the Bland case or when they expected a decision. In the meantime, Bland's family has filed a wrongful death lawsuit in federal court seeking unspecified damages. That case has a trial date of January 23, 2017.
The retrial of Baltimore police officer William Porter has been scheduled for June of next year. Porter was charged with involuntary manslaughter and reckless endangerment in the death of Freddie Gray back in April. The first attempt to try Porter resulted in a mistrial last week after jurors were unable to come up with a verdict. This is likely to present problems for state prosecutors who intended to use Porter as a material witness in the trials of the five other officers who have been charged in Gray's death. The second trial in the case of Officer Caesar Goodson, Jr., is scheduled to begin in early January. It is feared that Porter will plead the fifth and refuse to testify on grounds of self-incrimination if called as a witness against Goodson.
Legal proceedings are underway in a Pennsylvania courtroom as political prisoner and former death row resident Mumia Abu-Jamal seeks medical care for hepatitis C. Free Speech Radio Network's Nell Abram has more.
Mumia Abu-Jamal fell critically ill in March while serving life in prison without parole at Pennsylvania's SCI Mahanoy Prison. Convicted of the fatal shooting of a Pennsylvania police officer, Abu-Jamal spent 30 years on death row before his 1982 death sentence was overturned on constitutional grounds. In 2011, he was transferred to the general population. Since his hospitalization, Abu-Jamal says he's been systematically denied proper care and is asking the court to intervene. But the state claims that Mumia has failed to fully navigate the administrative process to seek additional medical care. Noel Hanrahan is director of Prison Radio. She's attending the hearings and joins us to discuss the case. First, bring us up to date. When did Mumia fall ill, and under what circumstances was he hospitalized?
Mumia Abu-Jamal has been very ill for over a year. He's had a full body skin rash. That's 80% of his skin with broken open wounds. This has been going on for a long time. Now, early in 2015, he went to the infirmary. He was put in the infirmary at SCI Mahanoy, and they started treating his incredible skin rash with topical steroids. The topical steroids triggered a diabetic reaction. They noted it in his charts. If we were out here and not in prison, they would have sent him to the hospital. They noted that it needed to be monitored, and then they didn't monitor him for 3 weeks. Mumia went into a diabetic coma on March 30th and was transported to a hospital, an outside hospital, unconscious in renal failure and was minutes from death. They stabilized him at the hospital and very quickly transported him back to the infirmary at SCI Mahanoy within 3 days. With no diagnostic testing, with merely stabilizing his blood sugar levels, Mumia filed a grievance. He demanded that they diagnose the underlying condition to the skin rash, this horrible skin rash, and he then has pursued it till now. So we are in court. This is the follow-up for Mumia's grievance and then a lawsuit forcing the Department of Corrections of Pennsylvania to both diagnose him and then treat him.
What's Mumia's condition now, and why exactly is he petitioning the court for an injunction? What's at the core of his petition?
Both his lawyers and the movement in general have been very active in trying to get Mumia diagnosed. So we were able to force the Department of Corrections to take him to a tertiary care medical facility in July. It was there that he was diagnosed with active hepatitis C. Now, since that time in July, the Department of Corrections has refused to treat Mumia. That means that he has been subject to a continuing infectious disease that attacks both your liver and other organs. The other organ that it attacked in Mumia's case, it's called an extrahepatic condition, is his skin. So Mumia has active hepatitis C, and he is being denied treatment. We are now right in court in federal district court in Scranton, Pennsylvania. We're there on Friday demanding a preliminary injunction, which means irreparable harm is being done to Mumia Abu-Jamal if he's not given treatment right away. Now, that treatment is, in fact, a cure. There is a cure for hepatitis C, a 95% cure rate, one pill a day that the prison could administer, but they were refusing to.
Explain hepatitis treatment and recent advances in curing the disease.
The treatment is amazing. In 2013, a Doylestown chemist, Michael Sophia, discovered a way in which to get the treatment to take. So before 2014 and the FDA approval of the new antiviral quick-acting cure drugs, there was a process where only 30% of the people who were treated with interferon and ribavirin were able to be cured. And it took a year and a half, and the side effects were very severe. It's now the case that it's one pill a day for approximately 12 weeks with very minimal side effects, and there's a 95% cure rate. So there's a drug on the market owned by the Gilead company that will cure people. Now, people have to know the context of hepatitis C. It's the most prevalent infectious disease in America. It kills more people per year than HIV, And 70% of the people don't know they have it. So there's 3 million people. It's very important that when there is a public health imperative such as this, treat a curable disease, that it happens, and that it actually happens inside prisons as well. For Mumia, who is being harmed because it's active and it's damaging his liver, and also for everyone else, because there's a 10,000 inmates who are positive for hepatitis C in Pennsylvania prisons.
Noelle Hanrahan, director of Prison Radio. There's an ongoing class action suit on behalf of those prison inmates. What's the status of that case, and what effect might the outcome of Mumia's case have on that matter?
It was filed and it's pursuing through the courts, the class action lawsuit. Mumia's case won't directly affect that lawsuit, but what it will do is it will force the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections and the corporate Correct Care Solutions healthcare company, which has the contract to provide medical care for Pennsylvania inmates, it will force them to develop protocols and to actually treat people with active hepatitis C. So we're confident that if we win this case in federal court, that it will change the possibilities for treatment for many inmates in Pennsylvania.
Back to Mumia's case, the hearing began on Friday. Was Mumia able to attend? How long do you expect the hearing to continue, and when do you expect a final decision from the court?
This was a really historic opportunity. Mumia was present through video, Skyping or streaming. He attended the entire hearing. He was on the witness stand. He was cross-examined. So that is something that hasn't happened. He performed very well. Our witnesses, we presented our case the first day, did a very, very good job. And though this is America, and it's often the case that prisoners and prisoner litigants don't prevail, the judge was really thorough and precise and very clear about the standards. We have the facts on our side. We have the law on our side, you know, and we are going to continue to work this case. Now, it is life and death. It is a situation where we need to be as assertive and aggressive as possible, because this is a disease that is... It just continues. I mean, he has an infectious disease that if they don't treat it, it could very likely